I don't think just coming out and blatantly saying that 95% of arbiters is completely useless is the right way to go about this. I'm not going to come on here and defend 100% of the arbiters.
Very often arbiters don't know where to place the kings to indicate a result on a DGT board, which is, I think, a basic sort of thing to know that you play. It makes me feel like maybe the arbiters don't understand chess very well. There are a lot of stories of certain events, norm events, where organizers and arbiters are complicit in pre-arranging games and tournaments, which is, it's not an issue of competence, but it's
more
pretty serious.
Related to corruption. Welcome back, everybody, to a special debate-style episode. Perhaps it's going to develop into more of a discussion, but obviously, Fabi, you made some comments in our last episode about 95% of arbiters being useless. Obviously, that was received with a lot of discussion, a lot of backlash from a lot of forums, but also one of our friends, international arbiter Chris Bird, decided to comment on it on Twitter, and we wanted to have him to express his opinions as well, and generally to have a constructive debate on the roles of arbiters in modern chess. So welcome, guys, and I'm just going to open that with an opportunity for both of you to kind of hash out that particular statement. Fabi, could you say what you meant by that statement and whether you would like to address anything in regards to it?
Sure, yeah. I'll just go quickly with some clarification. Yeah, I understand, of course, that the statement, which was an extreme statement, did cause some offense. And yeah, I probably would have worded it differently. Although it was said a bit offhand. It was also, of course, an exaggeration. I haven't met all arbiters. I haven't played games under all arbiters, so I can't possibly know what percentage are good or incompetent. And also, perhaps the definition of good or incompetent would vary from person to person. But it was supposed to portray more or less a general sentiment. I think I definitely had a sentiment, and I think other players might also have it, that a lot of arbiters... I don't know if it's the majority or the vast majority. And of course there are good arbiters, and I was also going to I was thinking about even mentioning some names of arbiters I've worked with who are skilled and who make good decisions and are attentive during games. And Chris, you were, of course, one of the people who came to mind, and we've done many tournaments together. But I've also had many experiences. I would even say the majority of experiences where there's a conflict in my games. And it's exceedingly rare that there are conflicts in chess. You know, most of the time things run very smoothly without anything having to happen besides the players play a game, stop the clocks, and move on to the next game. But very often conflicts are really mismanaged horribly. And sometimes in very small ways you see incompetence, which maybe I can get into a bit later, but just you see some small things and you realize that if it actually came to a dispute, that the arbiter wouldn't know what to do because they don't have a basic understanding of chess, it seems like. So that's more or less where I was going with the statement.
Chris, obviously as an international arbiter, an arbiter that has worked with Fabiano on numerous occasions, you found those statements irresponsible. Tell us what you found irresponsible about it, and why do you consider them to be irresponsible, and what corrections would you have in your opening statement?
Yeah, so I don't think just coming out and blatantly saying that 95% of arbiters is completely useless is the right way to go about this. I'm not going to come on here and defend 100% of the arbiters that I've worked with or that I know and say we're all perfect. We've all made mistakes. We all are human in any sport where there's referees. They make mistakes. Sometimes that's highlighted a lot more if you're on TV and you know it's a professional game, football or soccer or anything. You're going to make mistakes, but what you don't get the appreciation for is the numerous decisions that they do get right, or the number of things that they are doing to ensure that the players have a great playing venue or great conditions to be able to play the game, you know, ensure the room's quiet, the temperature's right, you know, everything that goes into it. It's not just about making that one decision when there's a dispute in a game or being attentive or anything along those lines. So I think even the most beginner arbiter I can put to work, you know, even if their skill set is not fully developed yet, I can get use out of, you know, these people depending on the level of the tournament and what's going on. I think you'll agree that most high arbiters I spoke to at the Olympiad, especially people from the Arbiters Commission, agree that they want to do more training. Just getting the arbiters being receptive to that. Of course, you can do as many episodes as you want via Zoom and training and all these refresher courses and seminars that they're putting on. But getting that practical experience, you know, of over the board tournaments and working at tournaments and actually having an issue come up and being able to learn from that is very limited. You can't always guarantee that something's going to come up. As you said, 99% of the tournaments that, you know, I oversee at the St. Louis Chess Club, hardly anything happens. And then when something does happen, we, you know, usually deal with it in a very quiet method. And a lot of the times the players aren't even aware of what's going on and things like that. So I think there are better ways for players like Fabi and Magnus came out and called out the arbiters at in the Global Chess League. I think there's better ways for them to communicate that they're not happy with the arbiting standards. I think it's much more when you have an issue in a game and the decision doesn't go your way. Remember, there's two players involved, and usually we can't satisfy both players depending on what the laws are and, you know, what happened in the game. So, you know, invariably one person is not happy and the other one is, you know, happy. So, but if you have a decision like that, I think it's okay to come out and say you're not happy with that decision or talk to the arbiter and get clarification and try and understand why that. But I think just the generalization from someone of Fabi's level, calling out the arbiter world basically and saying that, you know, 19 out of every 20 arbiters are completely useless is a little, you know, over the top. As to where you know, players like Fabius has such outreach, and you know, arbiters don't get a chance to necessarily defend themselves, you know, with that type of thing. So we don't have the reach that superstar chess players have. So I just think it was a little uncalled for. I think there are ways that certainly the top players can have this discussion with the Arbiters Commission or with arbiters in general that they know. Always happy to talk about arbiting, you know, like decisions that were made, specific cases that come up, what I may have done. Now, what I may have done doesn't necessarily mean what the arbiter did was wrong. You know, there are subtle ways that people can go about things differently according to the laws. There's various things that are very black and white, and you know, the result is that, but that's where some of the top level arbiters get away with, you know, being the top level arbiters is because we know how to make things work a little better within the laws and how to interpret them correctly and stuff like that. And all we can do is bring along the other arbiters with us and try and mentor them when we get the chance to do that and educate them as best we can, you know. And I hope, you know, the top level arbiters and the Arbiters Commission also feel the same. They just don't get the chance to work with the arbiters like as much as they would like.
And despite the controversy, I do feel like this is a good moment for us to be able to kind of delve deeper into the roles of an arbiter. And I do want to pull it down, pull it back a couple of notches and actually start with the question, what is the role of the an international arbiter? Because I myself, my dad is an international arbiter. I know how much he works before the competition as well as after the competition and during the rounds, but after and before the rounds as well. Can you take us through what an arbiter does in preparation for an event before round and after round as well, so that people get a more deeper understanding of what an arbiter does?
Yeah, so I mean, the short answer is that we are a referee, right? So we're there to watch the games, to make sure that nothing goes on during the games that's against the laws, or to resolve disputes. But there's a lot of an awful lot of work that goes on prior to the events. For instance, the upcoming US Championships that Fabio is going to be participating in a few days. I've spent a lot of work working with the organizers right now, even from my home, you know, remotely, making sure that the regulations and everything on the website are up to date, making sure that, you know, everyone is listed correctly for the tournament. We've already prepared for the women's tournament sort of norm calculations and had a meeting with the arbiters to work out how we're going to run things. We've met about the room layout, how we're going to set up the room with the broadcast team because they want their cameras in certain positions and various things along those lines. I've communicated with the DGT guy on how things are going to be set up and what tools we're going to have for dealing, resolving any claims, since there's, you know, no draw offers allowed during these tournaments and things along those lines. So we do a lot of work prior to that. When the arbiter team gets on site, you know, the day of the technical meeting that, you know, I have to organize and put together preparation work for, the arbiter team will also meet beforehand and we'll meet at the location and we'll go over the setup and how things are and if we need things changing at that point and the temperature in the room, which is very difficult to manage when you have open players and women players in the same room, because, you know, I guarantee that not everyone wants temperature at the same temperature, and then just making sure that everything is connected right and set up, and we want the playing conditions to be the perfect playing conditions we can for the players when they arrive. We also have the security processes and various things, and we've got to, you know, go over that with the arbiter team and basically meet. So there's a lot of prep work before we get to the stage of the players arriving for round one and showing up and playing the games. You know, they get to play the games and we get to monitor everything. And then, you know, so then there's all the work of while the tournament is in progress, making sure that results are entered correctly, just making sure that, you know, everything is great. Normally we used to have spectators at St. Louis. We don't have that. We have the luxury of not having to worry about those. But when we had spectators, were allowed to come and watch the games, which hopefully once they finish the renovations, that will be allowed again. We, you know, there's a lot of monitoring of third party things that don't necessarily involve watching the games, which, you know, it comes back to one of the things that Fabi mentioned about, you know, the arbiters aren't necessarily attentive or things along those lines. So then, of course, afterwards, there's a lot of paperwork to be filled out. There's a lot of rating reports to be done, you know, norms to be processed, various things that we have to do, especially for a national championship involving US chess and letting them know who won and World Cup spots and various things that we've got to figure out. So it's not just a question of, you know, there's a chess game in front of us and our only job is to watch that chess game that's going on. Of course, we'll have three arbiters for this event and 12 games to watch at a time, which means, you know, you've only got one set of eyes. You can only really watch one game at a time. So how you divide your attention between those games is a skill set that an arbiter needs to develop too as well. You know, you wouldn't think about just little things along those lines, but it's, there's, yes, as you said, there's a lot more to being an arbiter. If you look at the arbiter's handbook, I mean, it's this thick with regulations and rules and various things, competition rules and the fair play, you know, regulations and everything that goes into making a chess tournament tick. And what the people see on the broadcast, you know, it's an 11 round tournament, players playing chess, they finish chess and then they go for an interview. You know, there's a lot that goes on in that room to make it so that these guys can, you know, play chess to the best of their abilities and have the best conditions to do that.
And speaking of the rule book and how dense it is, obviously, there's some discussion about a recent rule that was more or less rediscovered by everybody. We will discuss that later on in the podcast. But Fabi, a lot of it was sparked because of this no increment situation, because of pieces flying. When illegal moves are being played, what can you do as an arbiter? And Fabi, what do you expect an arbiter to do in order to intervene and to smoothen the process of, you know, playing a fair game of chess?
Yeah, so the first thing is my comment wasn't directed at the event, although it was in relation, we were talking about the event, but I don't know what the conditions there are. So I wasn't saying that the arbiters there are necessarily doing a bad job. It had nothing to do with that event. It was a general statement, and I can sort of give some examples. As we said before, the vast majority of chess games, especially classical chess games, have absolutely no disputes, and usually nothing that an arbiter has to resolve in terms of, yeah, arbiter has many roles, but in terms of classical chess games, and especially at these high-level events where we have video footage and where there's not too many games going on, it's not an open tournament, I could go the next 2 years without having a single dispute in a classical chess game, and I wouldn't be surprised at all. But I have had a few that I can remember, including in world championship cycle events. And I think in every single case, it's been mismanaged. And they're all different types of things. It's almost never related to time scrambles. So the first thing that I can mention was that in one candidates event, that spectators were taking photos with phones with flash on. Phones or cameras, I can't quite remember, but there was flash, and it was during a time travel phase with an arbiter directly standing at our board, and my opponent kind of indicating to the arbiter to do something about it and nothing being done. And this was during a time travel phase, so it's really not on the responsibility of the players to make sure that, you know, spectators aren't doing something intrusive, which I think is like one of the main roles of the arbiter in case they're spectators, to make sure that the players aren't disturbed. And this is a candidates event. It's not your local club event where, you know, anything can go, maybe. One of the other things was a Grand Prix event with something which should have been very simple, because it was a threefold claim that my opponent made and I objected to. And normally it should just be resolved on the computer because the computer shows it. So the arbiters, two of them, both highly experienced international arbiters, check the game on the computer and inform me that it was threefold repetition. And then they tell us to agree to a draw. So we do. And then I recheck my score sheet and find out again what I thought, that there wasn't threefold. So I go to the arbiters again, and then they reverse the result. At this point, it's such a mess, of course, that they made a wrong ruling that I don't even know what they're supposed to do. They reverse the result and the game continues. And luckily, I guess for them, the game was drawn. So my opponent didn't file an appeal, which I don't know how that would have gone either. And there was no like huge conflict because the result of the game matched what they had ruled on before. But still, it shows that they couldn't figure out something which is shown on a computer. And those are like my two main things from world championship cycle events. Like a very common thing which has absolutely no negative effects, you could say, but it kind of speaks to competence in my view, is that very often arbiters don't know where to place the kings to indicate a result on a DGT board, which is, I think, a basic sort of thing to know that you play. It makes me feel like maybe the arbiters don't understand chess very well, or maybe they're not, I don't know, actually it seems like a kind of basic requirement that you understand how the DGT board functions. And more recently in the Olympiad, I had like a number of arbiters who were kind of intrusive themselves in terms of crowding around boards and generally being a little bit in the way, which again should be a basic requirement that arbiters don't get in the way themselves. So of course these are very few incidents over decades. So I have been playing for decades, and I can only name, you know, a handful of things, let's say, that have been either annoying or a little bit that showed a lack of competence. So it's not too many examples, but that I haven't had like a really clearly resolved dispute in high level events. The other issue I have is that a lot of arbiters And these are, again, in events that I don't really play in. But a lot of arbiters are complicit in pre-arranging tournaments, in my understanding of things. Probably not, you know, the tournaments that, let's say, not American events, and probably not very high-level events. But there are a lot of stories of certain events, norm events, where organizers and arbiters are complicit in pre-arranging games and tournaments, which is, it's not an issue of competence, but it's
more
pretty serious.
Related to corruption.
Yeah,
which I think it could affect pretty much everybody, from players to organizers to arbiters, sure. But it's mostly corruption.
And again, this has like a little bit in some small cases. I say small as in a few cases, not that they were unimportant, but some few cases have happened where arbiters have tried to prearrange, maybe successfully, or negotiated prearranged results in world championship cycle events, specifically Grand Prix events. Like, this is sort of known that this has happened. So again, that's not an issue of competence, but it's probably a more serious issue. And yeah, that speaks to corruption. That's not an arbiter thing, right? That, although arbiters are some of the
parties. I can't come on here and defend the arbiters that are doing any of that stuff. I mean, that's clearly not related to just arbitering standards. That's just related to, you know, just regular chess ethic issues, you know, that organizers, arbiters, and players are sometimes involved in, right? So, are we including those arbiters in the overall standards of arbiter? You know, that's not part of the skill set. That's just a general human corruption ethical issues, as you said.
I just want to clarify, I'm not trying to paint arbiters with the broad brush in terms of that. Like, I assume that the vast majority of arbiters have not done that. But it is some sort of corruption issue as well. But yeah, I just want to clarify that I would assume that this happens in a tiniest percentage of cases.
Yeah, and again, for players, for arbiters, for coaches, and for organizers as well, corruption is at pretty much every level. Now, Chris, could you address some of the points that Fabi just made? Specifically, perhaps we should talk about the candidates one, where, you know, in the heat of the battle, you allow players, you allow photographers, maybe visitors to take pictures with sound or with flash.
Yeah, so I mean, what I will say is that sometimes a lot of these regulations on what is allowed for media, their access and various things like that is beyond what the organizers are going to check with the arbiters beforehand, right? So if an organizer came around and says, you know, we want media access for the first 20 minutes. We want them to be able to, you know, use flash photography for that time. You know, we want them to come back in, once they reach the time control and various things along those lines. It's the arbiter doesn't get an awful lot of say in what an organizer who's maybe putting up all the money and various things to do that. Now, from my perspective, I know the organizers, obviously, in places like St. Louis, and I know organizers very well, that I will turn around and say, you know, this is probably not the most sensible thing for us to allow to happen. You know, do you mind if we do it this way and various things? Now, I don't think there's any excuse for an arbiter that allows or deliberately allows something to happen during the game that is going to disturb the players, right? We had the famous case of the candidates with Alireza walking around with the shoes, and that disturbed one of the players. And then the arbiter got sort of vilified for speaking to Alireza while his game was in progress, but while he was away and it wasn't his move, blah, 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 and various things. So, you know, an issue occurred, a problem, you know, that was disturbing players. The arbiter tried to take care of it and then sort of got shot in the foot by Alireza himself for, you know, trying to take care of it. So we want the playing conditions, or I say we. I'm hoping that the rest of the arbiter world wants the playing conditions to be the best playing conditions. I don't think there's an excuse for allowing flash photography later on, unless, you know, unless the operator didn't know it was happening or whatever. But I would assume that flash photography, you know, or if loud camera clicks or anything, especially in a time scramble, personally, I'll try and mush those people away. But you've also got to understand that, you know, media are allowed, the approved media are allowed access to certain things, and they don't necessarily always have the best equipment for chess events. Sometimes it is a little loud and it does get annoying, and it's hard to bridge that gap of where the line is, what you feel that the players can withstand and what, you know, you feel that you should not allow and get away with. So yeah, I'm not going to defend an arbiter that allows any sort of disruption, but sometimes you don't give a choice. For instance, at the Hall of Fame, if people start making noise on the second floor of the exhibit, that's out of my hands. I can't do anything to stop that. Yes, I can quickly get on my computer and message the club and say, hey, can you shut them up? But that is not going to stop that disturbance or that noise that sometimes carries and travels up, you know, while they're also trying to run a museum on the lower levels of the Hall of Fame. So sometimes things are just a little out of your hand that you've got to deal with at the time and, you know, try and get the playing conditions back to where you want them. You don't always get to pick and choose when that timing is. For instance, Irina Frush had an issue at the American Cup this year, where I think she was the only game going on. The room was very quiet, but then someone walked into the room from the back security and she could see that in her field of vision, and that disturbed her. So we eventually, you know, put a policy on that no one's allowed to come in at a certain point during time troubles and things along those lines, you know. But the incident had already happened. It had already disturbed her, she told me after the game. You know, so then we tried to correct it, and I apologize that that happened during that game. You know, there's no going back from that point. So sometimes things happen, you've got to deal with them. They're not always things that are in your control. You know, we had the tornado warning during the American Cup. You know, I mean, what do you do about that, right? So you can't always, you know, predict what's going to happen to disturb the players, but you can do your very best as an arbiter to make sure that sort of thing doesn't happen. The draw claim, repetition draw claim, that must be one of the most common instances of arbiter error, right? We're dealing with a draw claim. The laws actually specified that the players themselves should work out whether the repetition is correct or not. Of course, the arbiters usually take that out of their hands, go check on the computer. We run a special claim tool that I've not had any issues with yet, that pops up and tells us which move. That is currently in development to improve that for arbiters and make that better. I don't know if you've seen, if I have an issue where a player doesn't agree with it, I will actually unplug my laptop and take over the computer to them to explain to them why it is or it isn't. And at that point, if I've made a mistake, you know, the player will point that out to me, and, you know, then we'll make the ruling that way. You know, I've taken players over to my computer to show them when they haven't agreed with that type of thing, if I don't have something as mobile as a laptop. So there are ways to prevent this. Again, like I said previously, we're human. We make mistakes. We don't want to make mistakes. And of course, the mistakes that are highlighted are the ones that are in the important tournaments like Grand Prix or candidates or various things along those lines. Those are where you don't want to be making mistakes. A lot of the times, hopefully, if you're lucky as an arbiter, you look out and it, you know, the mistake you made has zero effect on the final outcome of that game. But where it doesn't, you know, this is the whole reason we have an appeals process too. If we didn't make mistakes, we'd never need an appeal process. That hopefully is there to go ahead and correct whatever that mistake was. It's not as good as getting the decision right in the first place, but, you know, there is a backup plan that hopefully is in effect to take care of this type of stuff too. So, you know, mistakes will happen. Hopefully you're not reading about me making a mistake anytime soon. But I will tell you as well, you know, my good friend Wayne Clark, who's since passed away, who's a national tournament director and international arbiter, we were dealing with an arbiter who had made a mistake, and they know they'd made a mistake, and they were beating themselves up about it. I'm sure you get this as a coach, Christian, with your players when they make mistakes, and you've got to, you know, talk to them and calm them down. And basically his response was, all my national tournament director title means, now I'm at the highest level, is that I've made many more mistakes than you've made until you get to that level. We all made mistakes. We live and learn from those mistakes. Yes, we feel sorry for the players that we made those mistakes in those games in. Sometimes it happens. Like I said, the rule book is enormous and not necessarily are clear on the interpretations on how you're meant to do things. So, you know, sometimes things happen. You don't want them to happen on the biggest stage. But, you know, it does. I can't say it doesn't, but, you know, it does.
And to narrow that down, Fabi, what would you say in your experience as an elite level player, what are the responsibilities, the critical responsibilities of a chess arbiter in your matches, in your cases? Obviously, you cannot be speaking too much about open tournaments and whatnot. You haven't played a lot of those in a while. But what would you say are the most critical responsibilities of an arbiter in closed high-level events?
Sure. Yeah. First, I just want to say, about the media, I understand that this is outside of arbiters' hands. The example I used wasn't a media example, because I try to be very understanding of the media pass that there is. Sometimes camera people do get a bit intrusive, but that is also part of the sport. That was just a spectator taking a photo. It wasn't some approved media. That was back in the days when there was lesser security at 2018, and there was live audience on the balcony as well, and also audience pretty much like a meter or maybe 2 meters away from our board. And I do feel like that was a clear case of like just inaction in a moment when you kind of have a job to do. And in regards to your question about what the role of an arbiter is, I can also speak in terms of like general tournaments, because I do have some memory of open tournaments. I it's been a while since I've regularly played opens, but I do still have some memory of them.
And you'll play in
terms of closed tournaments, where we have like, let's say, these Grand Chess Tour events, where we have very few players and very few games going on. And in terms of I think the main thing that the arbiter should have is an attention towards everything that's going on. And when it's five boards, then, and especially in classical chess, I think it's quite possible to do that, quite realistic. In terms of rapid and blitz, I don't think it's super realistic to be surveying five boards at once. But very often you do have two arbiters, and to be more or less have an idea of everything that's going on. Usually the kind of dispute phase will happen in a time trouble phase, where there's probably only one or two games still going on, because many of the other games have finished. And then it's quite realistic also to be attentive. And I think you mentioned or asked before about what happens when players start dropping pieces. And I also fully concede that this is mostly a player responsibility to play chess in a collected way, and not to be sloppy, even if sometimes it's difficult to make moves neatly. But it's still sort of your responsibility to put pieces where they belong. It's going to be difficult with no increment. That's true. I've played with no increment on rare occasions over the board, and it's very difficult to place your pieces in an orderly way and not to flag and not to drop pieces. But the reality is that we do see a lot of pieces being dropped. And yeah, Chris, I think that this is more a question to you in terms of what the arbiter's role is in this case. I would say that in general, if I were to make the rules, I would think that an arbiter should intervene as soon as pieces start rolling and then the clock is hit. And to give a warning first to the player who does it, and then maybe a time penalty for the second occasion. But I don't think it seems like, even though it may be entirely in the rules that the arbiter can only intervene once a player complains, I think that just for the spirit of the game, so that pieces aren't rolling and it's not a mess for everyone involved, that the arbiter should, once they see pieces being dropped and the clock being hit, so which is more or less a legal move, then the arbiter should intervene. That would be my interpretation of it.
Chris, would you like to?
Yeah, so I can. Yeah. So so we've got the laws, and most rapid and blitz games, and I can certainly speak for the Grand Chess Tour since I helped write those regulations. They're played under what's known as the inadequate supervision laws. This basically means we don't have like one arbiter per game, one arbiter per X number of games as are recommended to allow us to use the full competition rules. So time scrambles are going to happen in Rapid and Blitz. I think I've said that at various players' meetings, in my announcements before rounds start and various things. The players have an obligation to put those pieces on the right squares, make sure that they correct things before they press the clock, and various things along those lines. Now, one of the things that the inadequate supervision laws does state, and especially in terms of an illegal move, is that the time that we have to step in to enact a punishment for that illegal move is before the player makes his or her next move. So you can imagine you get down to very few seconds left. If you're watching multiple games at a time, your head is like a tennis umpire and you're sort of like this watching both games or whatever. So if you have five games still that all go down to the wire in a blitz time control, you can't watch everything at once. And then you have that very short amount of time to be able to step in and enact a penalty according to the laws. So the laws understand that these are for situations where you have a lot of games going on and very, not as many arbiters as you need for one set of eyes per game. For instance, the World Rapid and Blitz Championships that are coming up and previous ones have always been played under these specific laws. So the players also have a complete full right to claim an illegal move, before they make their next move. So do we want arbiters to step in? Yeah, I believe we do. And in the full competition rules that are in use, and we'll get to that later in terms of the Global Chess League, I think the arbiters certainly should step in and correct. I think, as you said, there's a difference between illegal moves and pieces flying everywhere, which might be considered under displaced pieces. Again, this is quite a nuance in the laws. And I think once you start having pieces flying everywhere, I think a lot of arbiters think if they don't step in at that initial moment and deal with it, that all bets are off at that point and it's just a free-for-all, right? At what stage are you then? If you've let it go for three, four, five moves and suddenly pieces are flying everywhere and the clock's bashing, at what point are you now going to step in and deal with that? And it's a very tough decision for an arbiter to make. There have been instances where I've seen players making a legal move. I've started stepping towards that board to go deal with it. The opponent responds and I can no longer get involved. So according to the law, so the law sort of tie the arbiter's hands in certain situations, which may not always be appreciated by, the players who are playing or the people who are watching or what's going on. So, yes, I always try and step in when I see an illegal move. I wish my colleagues would all do that. But just because you don't see someone step in doesn't mean that they didn't try to step in. And then they've had their hands tied by the laws as they're written and as we are enacting them. So there's a lot of different things going on here. Now, I will say, places like St. Louis, and when I'm an arbiter, we're set up much better in that location than, say, a Grand Chess Tour event that's in Europe, where the arbiters are sort of stationed off the stage and they're not necessarily up on the stage watching what's happening at the end of the game. And because that's also partially because they've been instructed to not get in the way of the cameras, not get in the way of the spectators, not do this, that, and the other. So one thing I will say is that in St. Louis, we're set up much better in the fact that we are able to walk in amongst those games and watch everything that's happening, especially towards time controls, towards the end of the game. You know, whereas in Grantchester in Europe, where they're set up with the stage and the arbiters are, you know, sort of told, don't get in the way of the spectators, the view of the players, don't get in the way of the cameras, you know. So sometimes they have a desk off the stage, which is not ideal for watching these, you know, the last few moves. You know, there's nothing better for an arbiter than to be physically up watching. You know, you're the best impartial judges to what happened in a game. I know we've got video replay and access to things along those lines, but what the arbiter sees, you know, you're going to miss a lot of things that are potentially happening when you're not at the game. So, and then by the time you've walked from the edge of the stage to try and get involved in that game, it's 10 moves further on, and that situation has totally gone. So I think arbiters can help themselves when they're setting themselves up for success or being able to handle these situations that come up. I think there's certainly something to be said for getting involved in the setup process of how things are set up and being able to get involved. But yes, I want arbiters to get involved in games. A lot of people don't necessarily see it that way. They want the arbiters to stay out of it. In the US chess rules, their philosophy is completely different. They want the game to be between the two players. Now, this is obviously separate from the FIDE laws, which is much more, if you run in anything that's FIDE rated, you've got to use the FIDE laws. But in the US chess rule set themselves, they don't want you interfering in a game. They want that to be between the two players. So there's a lot of times where you can't even get involved in a game in the US chess world when you want to, because the rules specifically don't allow you to. So, you know, like I said, inaction on the part of an arbiter doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't see it and they didn't try to do something about it. It could just be well be that the laws don't allow them to step in because of the specifics of what's going on. It's a blitz and we're using the inadequate supervision version of the laws.
Yeah. So in regards to your point about inadequate supervision, I think I understand that the rules do get in the way, and it's probably quite a difficult situation. And also things are moving very quickly. But it's rarely one illegal move. So it's not like the arbiter has to step in immediately. And if an arbiter sees that a player is continuing to make illegal moves, they could definitely be prepared to step in, and they could be ready in case another one happens. And usually we see with these games where players start dropping pieces and pressing the clock, and very often they no longer start making moves which are even attempted to be legal. Like they're just moving their hand and then knocking a piece over, pressing the clock, and everything's flying. I think at some point an arbiter should step in and should also be prepared to step in, and probably within the rules they can time it so that they get in, and if both players are making illegal moves, they don't have to penalize one player. They could give a warning or something, but definitely. And also from my experience, like not just playing events where sometimes things get messy, but also watching events where things get messy, usually or very often an arbiter is there. These very often happen in critical games where there's one game left, for example. Like we can talk about the Global Chess League. It was the like final decisive game of the match. Definitely, if there are arbiters there at all, then they must have been watching the game, right? Or at least they should have been watching the game, because there was only one game left, right? So they definitely.
So I don't know if you've seen the setup that they have in the Global Chess League. So the arbiter is sort of behind the cameras. So I mean, it takes a few steps to get there. But again, in terms of Global Chess League, and I think we'll maybe visit some of the issues that happen there. They have less excuses because they're not actually using the inadequate supervision version of the laws there. They're using the full competition rules, which basically denies them that sort of get out of jail free card anyway. So, Sorry.
Yeah, no.
I understand that this is go ahead, Fabio. This is sort of a rule that's written in to perhaps help arbiters who don't really have a way to mediate this during in the heat of the moment. But it also shouldn't be used as a get out of jail free. Like it seems like it's kind of taking responsibility off the arbiters at moments when they're needed, because both players have lost control, which is their fault. But regardless of how we got to that point and whose fault it is, you need someone to intervene so that it's not a mess anymore.
The responsibility of players? Sorry to interrupt. Could it be the responsibility of players to claim that, let's say, my opponent is not making legal moves anymore, like either off-center pieces or pieces are just like flying? Should it be the responsibility of players to claim that?
I think so. I also think that once players are in that mode where they're just trying to avoid getting flagged, they're probably not thinking about much else, but they do have that responsibility, I think, to either play in an orderly way, or if their opponent's not doing so, then to stop the clock and complain about it. But we rarely see that the case. And the second question is like, whose responsibility is it after the players no longer do that? I think a famous, very famous case from a very important event was the Women's World Cup in 21. This game between Matanadze and Badelka, right? Which was an Armageddon game, so you expect perhaps some. These are probably the games where you're most likely to see disputes, and probably related to either illegal moves or something to do with the clock, right? And since it was the final game of the match and probably one of the last games remaining of that day, and also because there are so many arbiters in the World Cup event, there must have been multiple arbiters standing around and watching as the players allowed pieces to basically fall on the ground, and both of the players. So although it might be difficult, there has to be a way for the arbiters to do something at some moment in the game. Otherwise, I think it does speak to like some level of uselessness, right? If they have no way to mediate this or to ensure that proper play is happening, then what exactly are they doing there?
Chris, would you care to?
Yeah, I will I will say, you know, ideally, yes, an arbiter steps in, and hopefully we catch the first infraction, right? That's the time to sort of take a breath and step in, and you want to catch that first one and penalize that first one, and then hopefully the players are much more reasonable from that perspective onwards. It's really tough in a no increment game when players are down to barely seconds and things are happening. Like I said, I think at some point the arbiter just makes a determination that, listen, the players are clearly just going along with this because, you know, as you said, they're in that mindset of I'm playing. I don't have a second to just stop and think and pause the clock and say, hey, you know, this is silly. You know, what's going on here? You know, there's got to be something that could be done about this. Because both players are usually, you know, the ones doing it, and you know, neither one wants to be the one. You know, that you can't stop and think to make that claim, I assume. I feel an arbiter should step in. You want to try and catch that first infraction, but I think once you get beyond a certain point, I think the arbiter mindset might be, you know, I'm just going to let this play out because I missed that point where I needed to step in. The players are obviously, or not obviously, but they're continuing, and the sort of chess playing will decide the outcome of this game. Yeah, yes, we've seen various silly endings or with things happening that I've gone online and said, this is not serious chess. This is not what we should be watching in such prestigious events, not like the World Cup, not, you know, not the Global Chess League, not whatever. You know, we've often had Armageddon as a playoff in Grand Chess Tour, US Championships. You know, that's always been part of the playoff structure. I've slowly worked that out, so it's not like it's going to take a long time for us to get to an Armageddon. So, you know, we try and fight things as an ABBA team from that perspective. Of course, you know, the organizers want excitement. They want this. You know, there was the Armageddon series that was in Berlin, right, where it was just purely a lot of those games were a mess. I mean, Dominguez and various people having similar games, but they want that. So, you know, if an arbiter stepped in, you know, you might be risking your job as an arbiter stepping in and getting involved in this, because that's actually what the organizer wants to get, attract viewers and excitement and various things along those lines. So there's a lot that might go through an arbiter's head, you know, when trying to work out, you know, do I actually step in here at the end of this game that's now such a mess that, you know, I'm not even sure I'm going to be able to resolve this issue.
But just to clarify, are this type of situations covered in the rule book of arbiters? Are you guys, whenever you go through training, do you guys have this type of scenarios laid out and asked, okay, what's your decision in this and that case?
Well, I mean, you bring up training. So there is, let's put this out there. There is no formal training for arbiters that happens. Okay, arbiters become arbiters, you know, in the US chess, you sign a piece of paper to become a club tournament director and you work your way up the ladder like that. You get training, mentorship at events that you're working at. And as things happen, you know, you might be able to get some sort of education on site and various things from people who are willing to train, and you impart your knowledge to other players, other arbiters that are willing to learn from you. I get a lot of my training from watching bad things happen on the internet that has happened at a tournament. And then we discuss, you know, how would we handle that? You know, what are we meant to do? So, you know, the Arbiters Commission are trying to introduce sort of refreshers, but once every 4 years, and that's just to make sure that arbiters are staying up with the latest laws and various things. Yes, there are in the laws, there are situations that cover what we should do if displaced pieces, illegal moves. It's all in there. But again, you know, we've got the inadequate supervision version of the rapid and blitz laws that, you know, on illegal moves, if we don't step in by a certain time, then we let it go. But, you know, other than that, we should be, that everything is covered in the laws. You know, if pieces are going flying, yes, there's a law that covers displaced pieces. We shouldn't be allowing that to happen. We should be stepping in and doing that. Again, it's not always as black and white as you want it to be. You know, it's in the rules, you know, it's in the laws, but, you know, getting an arbiter to actually always follow those laws and whatever, and also, you know, having the understanding of when, you know, you don't necessarily need to get involved because it's not going to affect anything, or it's not going to change anything. Or like one of the things that's been happening a lot recently, I've noticed, and even in the high level events in St. Louis, is players will make a move. And I'm not just necessarily talking about being low on time. They will make a move, they'll press the clock, and then they'll readjust the piece back onto the square where they should have put it properly in the first place. Now that's against, you know, you shouldn't be adjusting the pieces on your opponent's time. So that's against the laws. There's something in the laws that we can do about that. But, you know, a lot of the times, if players both have an hour left, that is not affecting anything. So if an arbiter doesn't step in and correct it at that point, it's probably, no one's ever going to know. No one's ever going to notice. It doesn't affect the player, their opponent, and various things. Now, if they're doing it with a minute left and continuously doing it, like I had to penalize Alice Lee in a recent event because she was doing it constantly. I think it was the Crowns Cup. So I stepped in. And awarded the opponent 2 minutes because she, you know, you can't continuously keep doing that. That's against the laws. So at some point, you've got to enact and try and correct a behavior that you see is happening. It's not necessarily the worst behavior in the world that's going to affect the result, but, you know, at some point, you have to step in and it is against the laws and deal with it. So, and you know, I wish arbiters would do that. Of course, the most contentious games that are happening are these fast games, the blitz games, where people are very long time. I don't know whether 1 second increment or 2 second increment is enough to stop whatever's going on from going on, you know, whether it's enough to stop the pieces flying from wherever they're flying and stuff like that. But, you know, obviously the arbiters there have sort of set a precedence that they're not going to step in at certain things, you know, sorry, in the Global Chess League, that they're not going to sort of step in and stop all of this madness from going on.
Well, finally, I do have to talk about this game, Nihal versus Darda. We've been discussing the flying of the pieces. We're not going to cover that, but there's been this situation of flagging. We've seen flagging, and generally, you know, the players accept the result. But Nihal stopped the clock with 2 seconds on his clock left. Darda, I believe he was up to about 10 seconds, so he was definitely going to get flagged in that position. He stopped the clock, and he claimed a draw in a position in which his opponent still had a rook and a pawn. He had an extra bishop, but still, there are ways in which he could have lost that one. Could you give us your interpretation of this rule, and how do you see it being used in high level competitions, and
Yeah,
perhaps an analysis
so
of that situation as well?
so it's interesting because these guidelines, as they call that, these used to actually be in the laws, like Section 10 of the laws, and then they were sort of moved to these guidelines at the end because now increment and delay is very prevalent in the chess world. Digital clocks have sort of advanced the this aspect of it, and now the increment and delays are not specifically there just to help arbiters, right? They're there to help players finish games naturally and have them reach a natural conclusion, and that whatever increment or delay is in effect is enough for the player to finish out playing that game as best they can to get the actual correct result for that game. Now, when you're not using an increment for classical or standard chess in FIDE terms or rapid chess, in FIDE terms, there are these guidelines. Guidelines 3 is this section of the FIDE laws that everyone's probably forgotten about because nothing is ever run without an increment or a delay nowadays anyway. And they don't apply to blitz. So blitz is, I think it's considered that the clock is part of the actual game. You know, the time management is a huge part of blitz chess. So it only refers to rapid and classical games. And you can only use this if it's actually been announced beforehand. Now, because of the issue and the appeals and people I've spoken to, it was determined that during the technical meeting, this was brought up, and they did say that these claims would be allowed. So the fact that the first time we saw it was in the Nihal Darda game was interesting because it could have been utilized by Magnus
I just
in
want
his game against
to
Alireza.
I just want to mention one thing, because I think it was used in one other game. I think it was Gunina against Kaneru, maybe. It was definitely a game of Gunina's, and it was an equal position, but not a drawn position. And she made this claim that her opponent wasn't trying to win on the board on and was trying to win on the clock, which it was the case. She was flagging her. I mean, she had probably 2 seconds left when she made this claim, and the claim was rejected. And from my understanding of position, basically she was not trying to win on the board. Like, you could just see that she was making random queen moves and random checks with the aim of eventually flagging her opponent. So how are these laws interpreted, and is it the sole or power of the arbiter to decide which position is a drawn, which is not a draw?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, if there's a claim made, if there's a claim made and the arbiter has to interpret, you know, this, I just go back to the Nihal Darda game. Nihal is a bishop and a pawn up. So you've got to the glossary different determines this as not trying to win by normal means or just not trying to actually win the position, right? So a normal means means that it's got to be a position where reasonably the only way you're going to lose this game is by flagging. You know what I mean? So that, you know, I think in the Nihal Dada game, that is much more clear that the only way Nihal was going to lose that game was on time. And the arbiter can take a lot of things into consideration, looking at the level of the players, you know, based on their own understanding. But yes, the arbiter is the ultimate judge in this decision. Now, US Chess, where some of this stuff about adding in the guidelines, there's this option to add a clock that has a 5 second increment and give the opponent 2 minutes and let the game play out. This is very much part of what the insufficient losing chances claims aspect of US chess rules were. If the opponent did agree to a draw, you sort of threatened to put this 5 second increment on the game, with the time remaining, but give the opponent a couple of extra minutes too, and let the play out to a normal let the game play out to a normal conclusion. If you'd have said that you were going to do that to Dada, he would have probably, I think in my estimation, said, if he has a 5 second increment, he's going to beat me in this position. Like, I'm not going to win this. I'm not going to draw this position. Like, I'm going to lose this game. So I will accept the draw. Right. So that is, you know, that's not the aspect of this, you know, trying to win by normal means, type of claim, which is also in the same guidelines. So it's not new. It's not a new thing to those of us who were playing chess 25, 30, 40 years ago, where we never had an increment. So we've always had, you know, there was always this aspect of the rules in play. And when I moved to the US, you know, this insufficient losing chances thing was brand new to me, but there was a lot of times we played games without an increment or delay, and that sort of came into effect, you know, so and you utilize that. And their definition there was that a Class C player would reasonably be expected to hold the position against a master. So you're talking about positions in my eyes that, like, he's a queen up, you know, that type of thing. Like, he's not going to ever lose this position.
This is very subjective. This is not
No,
really.
incredibly subjective. And you know, but like I said, from the arbiter's perspective, in my eyes, the Nihal Dada game is much more like I, you know, agree with that claim. Like,
Yeah, no,
on
that
that
game, I think that
basis, that,
we can
right.
agree that
So,
if.
but we have the same situation today, I think it was with Magnus and Anish. Anish had a position with a rook and a bishop, and Magnus had the queen. And I think Magnus offered Anish a draw, and Anish said no. And then so Magnus paused the clock and just asked the arbiter to declare it a draw at that point. And the arbiter did. Whereas that to me is much more subjective. That's not as clear. Like, I think just turning around to these guys and saying, you know, if you think it's a draw, just go ahead and repeat a few times, might be a much better solution than just saying, declaring outright, yes, this is a draw. Because this was a queen against a rook and a bishop. Now in their hands, yes, it's going to be, you know, probably a draw. Like, if Magnus is saying it's a draw, and you know, you know, who am I to argue with that, right? I'm not.
Although,
But
are
it's
you sure
much
it's the
more
same?
sub
Because,
it,
like, in the final, like, I think I was watching the game in the final, maybe it was another game, because in the final position, Magnus has 2.5 minutes and can repeat by at will with, like, Queen
yeah,
E8,
I
Queen.
just saw a video earlier today. So I thought it was from today's game. Magnus had the white pieces, Anish had black. And you know, yes,
Like, I think
but
that the
there
game.
wasn't an actual repetition on the board, as
Oh,
far
no,
as
there
I could
wasn't.
tell.
But of course, Magnus, I
Right.
mean, doesn't need to claim a draw on this because he can just repeat
Right.
moves. But I think this game of, like, Gunina against Salimova is interesting from that perspective because, like, just to give some
Yeah.
context about the game, it's a position of queen, rook, and two pawns against queen, rook, and two pawns, and of course that is not a forced draw. But let's say we start the position on move 43, and Gunina has 36 seconds. And then the next 17 moves, the game finishes on move 60, after which she runs out of time. The pawns have stayed in the same place, and the pieces have stayed in the same place, except that Black's queen has moved around, checking White's king. So nothing has
Right.
changed in the last 17 moves. So the game was not declared a draw. It was declared that she lost. She made a claim with 2 seconds on the clock that And this was before the Darda against Nihal game. So she had already tried this rule, and the claim was rejected. And now I can see this going either way, because it's not a forced draw for sure. And there are major pieces on the board, and White's king is vulnerable to checks. On the other hand, Black has made no progress, nor really attempted to make progress, and hasn't. And there's it's difficult to imagine how Black could even make progress in the future, looking at the position. So,
yeah, and that's meant to be one of the main considerations, is whether the person is actually trying to win the position. And if they're not trying to actually win and make progress in the position, and they are basically just trying to flag, that should be one of the key indicators that you would agree to the draw, or you would, you know, accept the claim in that situation. The arbiter also has the option. Now, it's very difficult to do if a player makes this claim with 2 seconds left. Now, if Gunita had made the claim with 30 something seconds left and said, you know, I don't, you know, I'm making this claim, the arbiter has the option of allowing the game to continue and then making a ruling later based on whether he feels the opponent is trying to actually win the game, or just flag the opponent. So there are
even more. So like it shouldn't be the responsibility of the player to make two draw claims based on the same.
No, I mean, it would still be the same claim. So you would still, you know, the claim would still be valid. It's just the arbiter is using this option to reserve judgment on the initial claim based on what he sees in the future. So it again, you know, nobody has known about these guidelines or whatever until, you know, they're sort of being forgotten about, right? Until this event came to the fore, and now this is a rapid event that's not using an increment or delay, and these rules are in effect. So, yeah, I mean, I would hope that the arbiter team did a lot of figuring out on how they were going to handle this once it was announced that this rule was going to be in effect. I can't speak for the arbiters. I can't. You know,
for me, this sounds like a very outdated rule, a rule that we used to have when we had the analog clocks.
Exactly the same rule.
But a rule that should have stayed with analog clocks and not be carried over to the clocks that we have right now. When you put no delay as an organizer, you're obviously looking for some type of match, some type of event, some type of, you know, situations when players don't have any seconds on the clock. To be honest, Nihal, you know, getting a piece up in the last five moves of the game and then immediately claiming a draw with 2 seconds, I'm not sure he should have been awarded that draw. He didn't have enough time to make the moves. It was a time management situation, time management question, and you're penalizing the player that has used his time more efficiently. So I don't know.
One of the questions is whether the game should have, you know, actually got to that point, right? So a long time before that, when pieces were happening, whatever, you know, I was talking about this earlier,
right,
that the arbiter should hopefully catch that first infraction and not let this type of stuff, you know, try and nip it where it was and stop it from progressing any further. You know, but I don't think you could blame Nihal for actually utilizing the rules
not.
And the laws that the tournament had in place instead were going to be in place, right? So,
of course not.
They could have easily not announced that these guidelines were in effect and just let it play out. If that's what's going to happen, that's what's going to happen. So,
I'm not sure he, you know, again, he got the extra piece, I believe, when he had perhaps 4 seconds on his clock. Like, he didn't have enough time to prove that he's going to be able to not lose that one. Obviously, we know Nihal being 2700, he's not going to lose that type of position. But I just feel like the player that managed his time better, which in this case is Darko.
He's also penalizing himself. He's penalizing himself a little bit, if you think about it, because if he has ample time, or like I said, if you added a 5 second increment into that, he's going to win that game, right? I would put my money on him winning that ending. So he's sort of penalizing himself by agreeing to a draw at that point. It's sort of a safety net. So he doesn't get the win. He only gets a draw. Now, yes, he would have lost on time if he hadn't been able to claim that. So it's sort of a middle ground, right? This whole thing is just Remember, you're only getting a draw to these claims. You're not getting a win. You're not, you know, but you're not getting a win, but you're not getting a loss.
I see that. I can
but
see
I've
that.
Always, I've always dealt with these situations personally from the US Jets perspective. I can honestly say I've never had to rule on this from a FIDE laws perspective, but from a US Jets perspective, unless the position is very, very, very clear that this Class C player is not going to lose this against the master, I'm rejecting the claims, or I'm offering to put a delay on the game because that's one of the options too. So, you know, if in this position, I don't think I'm accepting that a Class C player is not going to lose this against the master. You know, even though they're a bishop and a pawn, there's just too much can happen. I've seen too much can happen from those. So it's got to be something really, really clear cut. But like I said, the US chess version just immediately allows you to put a delay clock on the game if the player doesn't accept that it's a draw, or the master doesn't accept that it's going to be a draw, and you let the game play out naturally with that 5 second delay now in effect. So if the player feels they can go ahead and win it, they have the right to go ahead and win it, but that's the price the master pays for not accepting the draw in that, you know, when it's being offered, when this person makes this insufficient losing chances claim. So that was sort of how we ruled it from the US chess perspective. I've never had to rule on it using the FIDE laws and their normal means definition and various things along those lines. So
I just want for different perspectives
to these arbiters.
Yeah. Because you mentioned you said safety net, which is sort of how I viewed that he was approaching it, which I think is a consideration, especially in a match situation like this, where he was taking the risk that he would be able to win in the amount of time he had, because he understood when he had 30 seconds left or even a minute left that there was a serious risk that he could flag, right? But he took the decision in a winning position. He was winning for nearly the entire game, that he would go for the win. And perhaps he was looking at it from a match perspective, but he wasn't able to win the game in the amount of time he had. So this was sort of a decision that he made during the game. And then he has the safety net once it's beyond clear that he's not going to win, as in checkmate his opponent, in the amount of time that he has. And he doesn't even get close to checkmating his opponent. So it feels also a bit of a cop-out that you're able to go for the win, taking risk that you're going to run out of time, and also taking risk that, you know, you at some point maybe he was potentially could have messed the position up to losing it, right? Not at that moment, but earlier on in the game. And then once you know that you can no longer win the game, then you say, okay, I claim a draw, even though time was always an aspect. Like, both players were aware of the importance of time, even going back maybe 20 or 30 moves. And then there's also the other issue that was the final position even reached legally? Like, how many of their moves were legal?
Yeah, I mean, we were saying earlier that once they get into the heat of moment, players might not think to stop the clock and claim any of this. But Nihal was certainly, I think, always had this in the back of the mind, right? With 2 seconds left, he just very casually paused the clock and made this claim. So I think he would have, you know, being able to easily claim that there was an illegal move or displaced pieces or anything at any particular time that happened. Yeah, I mean, once you... So to touch on this, the Global Chess League state in their regulations that they use what's known as the Rapid Laws A2, A4, which are the full competition rules. Now, full competition rules mean if there's an illegal move or something happens, the arbiter has to step in. Like, you will, so if you don't notice an illegal move for so many moves, you still step in, you stop the clock, and you go back to when that illegal move was, you correct it, and then you penalize, and then you carry on the game from that point. So, you know, they're using these full competition rules, not the inadequate supervision laws. So I don't think they have the number of excuses to not go back and deal with that and let all this thing happen. But in terms of, you know, once I guess you've reached that position and then a player makes that claim, you're sort of obligated to just make the the claim on that basis? I mean, do you want the arbiters to then go back and say, well, you know, there was an illegal move 15 moves ago, so we're going to go back to that, and now we're going to continue the game and, you know, give someone a minute or whatever at this point, and, you know, and carry the game from that point. I don't think that was ever going to happen. You know, like I said, you know, but given that they're using the full competition rules, I think they're sort of obligated to step in and deal with an issue when it happens. And that obligation is very difficult with the time controls and everything that they've been sort of given with the format of this tournament.
Guys, I think that was, in general, a very fruitful discussion. I know we're most of us running out of time right now, so we're going to have to close it right about now. But thank you, Chris, for joining us. That was very insightful. Fabi, as always, a pleasure. And let us know what you think, the audience. What do you guys think are the responsibilities of a chess arbiter? What do you think should have been done better in the game between Nihal and Darda? Obviously, the discussion is open. Magnus also gave us his point of view about that one. One thing is for sure, it does seem like Nihal might have been the only one paying attention to the technical meeting. So kudos to him for that one. He knew the rules. But yeah, that's more or less everything we have for this episode. Once again, Chris, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you guys in the next episode. Cheers.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.